You know, there is this very specific, very brief moment of anxiety that I think every single developer knows intimately.
Oh,
You're
yeah.
typing away, you open a bracket, maybe you start typing a function name, and for just a split second, nothing happens.
The cursor just sits there blinking at you, mocking you.
Exactly. And in that tiny millisecond, your brain just goes, "Does the computer know what I'm doing? Did I break something? Is the server down?"
And
And then
that's
pop, the little menu appears.
with the exact command you needed, the red squiggly line vanishes.
And order is restored in the universe.
It's that little dopamine hit that really powers modern software engineering. We rely on it.
We totally do. We take that tight feedback loop for granted. We treat our editors like they're magic. But
Yeah.
today, we're going to tear that experience apart.
We are.
We're doing a deep dive into this incredible study guide for a university course on software tool construction.
This thing is basically a blueprint for building a programming language from the ground up, and not just the language itself, but all the tools around it.
Right. This isn't just about syntax. We're talking about the entire invisible machine, the compilers, the language servers, the web integrations, all the stuff that turns a plain text file into that smart, helpful coding environment.
It's a journey into the black box. We all stare at the outside of the box. Today, we're actually climbing inside.
So our mission today is to trace the life of a single keystroke, and we're going to be looking at a project called YAML.
And we have to stop right there. The first thing the study guide basically screams at you in bold text is, "Do not confuse this with YAML, the data format."
Right. No indentation nightmares here. No fighting with white space.
None of that.
Yeah.
This stands for yet another math language. It's a custom-built domain-specific language, a DSL. It's the laboratory specimen for this whole
It's
course.
small enough to get your head around.
Exactly. It's not C++ NAMA, but it's complex enough that you need real industrial-strength tooling to make it work.
Okay, so before we dive into the deep architecture stuff, let's just ground ourselves. What does this language actually look like? If I open a file, what am I seeing?
It's surprisingly familiar. I mean, if you've ever used TypeScript or C or Java, you'll feel right at home. You've got M for functions, const for variables,
So all the basics.
all the basics. It does math, control flow with if and else, loops, standard stuff.
But the notes mentioned a specific quirk about the types, something that apparently trips students up.
Yeah, this is interesting. The language has integers, floats, and booleans, and it allows string literals, so you can write, "Hello world" in quotes inside a print statement.
Okay.
But, and this is the catch, there is no string keyword. You can't declare a variable of type string.
Wait, so I can say hello, but I can't store it anywhere.
Exactly. The language is designed purely for numerical calculations. Those strings are just for like printing output. It's those little design constraints that make building a compiler so interesting.
Right.
You have to enforce these rules.
Okay, so we have our language, YAML. Now, the guide talks about the project structure. They didn't just throw all the files in one folder. They used an X monorepo. Why is that a big deal?
Well, think about it. In a real-world tool chain, you usually have multiple outputs. You might have a command line tool, a plugin for VS Code, maybe a website.
And you definitely don't want to be copy-pasting your compiler logic for every single one of those.
Precisely. That is just asking for bugs. So an X monorepo lets you organize your code into apps, the things that actually run in libs, the shared logic.
So the compiler is a library.
Right. It's the core engine. It just sits in the middle, and all the different apps just borrow it.
All right, let's look at that core library. This is the engine room. I type const x equals 5. What's the very first thing that happens?
The first step is always lexing. The computer just sees a stream of raw characters, CONST. The lexer's job is to group those into meaningful tokens.
So it sees const and says that's a keyword. It sees x and says that's an identifier.
And it is an operator. Yeah. It's basically sentence diagramming for your code.
And after that comes parsing. This is where a tool called ANTLR comes in.
Another tool for language recognition. It's a huge deal in this space, an industry standard.
So what does ANTLR do?
It takes that list of tokens and builds a tree structure, the concrete syntax tree, or CST. The CST is incredibly detailed. It knows about every parenthesis, every semicolon, every little bit of white space.
But the computer doesn't need to know where the semicolons are to actually run the math, does it? It
It
just
just.
needs the logic.
Exactly. The CST is too noisy for analysis, so what you usually do is convert that into an AST, an abstract syntax tree. This is the clean, stripped-down version of your code.
It just keeps the meaning.
It just keeps the meaning. Now, usually this is a two-step process. You build the messy tree, then you walk through it to build the clean one. But this project does something clever.
An optimization.
Yeah, a really cool one. In the grammar file itself, the file that defines the rules of the language, they embedded code actions. So as ANATLR is reading the text and figuring out, oh, this is a variable declaration, it executes a little snippet of TypeScript right then and there.
So it builds the clean AST node immediately.
Instantly. It skips the middleman. It builds that final logic tree while it's reading the file.
That sounds way faster.
It is faster, and it keeps the logic right next to the grammar definition. But, and there's always a but in compiler design. This creates a specific headache.
I think I saw this in the notes. Something about counting.
The off by one error to end all off by one errors, it's maddening. ANTLR, by default, counts characters starting from one. The first letter in your file is index one.
Okay, that seems fine. Logical, even.
To a human, yes. But the language server protocol, the thing that VS Code and almost every modern editor uses, starts counting at zero.
Oh, no.
So every single time the compiler talks to the editor, they are speaking a slightly different dialect of math.
And if you forget to translate.
Your error squiggles will be shifted one character to the right for the rest of your life. It just looks sloppy.
That sounds like a debugging nightmare.
Yeah.
You're searching for a logic error, but it's just your counting.
It is the definition of fiddly, but once you get the coordinates right, you have your AST, you have the structure, and now we get to the feature that defines modern coding.
Autocomplete, the magic trick.
It really feels like a trick.
Because I always assumed the editor just had, I don't know, a dictionary.
Yeah.
I type C, it looks for words that start with C. But the study guide says it's way, way smarter than that.
Much smarter. Because context is everything. If I'm inside a math function, I shouldn't see suggestions for, like, text commands. The technique they use is called controlled failure.
Controlled failure.
Right.
That sounds ominous. How does failing help us write code?
Okay, so imagine you're typing const my var and you stop. The cursor is just blinking. You want a suggestion.
Right.
The editor, the client, has no idea what to suggest. So it cheats. It inserts the dummy character right where your cursor is. In this project, they use a dollar sign.
So the code actually becomes const my var. It's for a split second.
For a split second, yes. Then it sends that modified, totally broken text to the parser.
But wait, a dollar sign isn't valid in this language? Shouldn't the parser just crash and burn? Throw a huge syntax error?
Normally it would, but they rigged the grammar. They specifically designed the parser to recognize that dollar sign in certain places. When the parser hits it, it triggers a special error path.
It's a trap.
It's a trap that captures information. The semantic analysis part sees the dollar sign inside a token. It might look like foot, and it generates a specific diagnostic object.
An error message.
But instead of saying syntax error, this diagnostic says something like, I found a dollar sign here, but I was expecting an integer or a Boolean.
I see it now. The error message is the feature.
Precisely. The language server catches that specific error, makes sure the user never sees it, and it just reads the payload. It sees expected, integer, Boolean. So it pops up that little menu in VS Code that says integer and Boolean.
That is unbelievably clever.
Mm.
You are intentionally breaking the code to force the compiler to confess what it would have accepted.
It turns the compiler's strictness into a helpful assistant. And this whole conversation, the editor sending the text, the server sending back the list, is all handled by the LSP.
The Language Server Protocol.
Which was Microsoft's big gift to the programming world, really. Before LSP, if you invented a new language, you had to write a brand new plugin for VS Code, another one for Vim, another one for IntelliJ.
It was a nightmare.
And they were all doing basically the same thing. LSP created a separation of church and state. The editor handles the UI, the server handles the intelligence.
And they just talk over JSON RPC.
Yep. Just sending little text messages back and forth. Text documented open, text documented out change, completion item resolve.
It sounds so simple.
Uh-huh.
But let's talk about the brain of that server, the document service. Because code doesn't live in a vacuum. My files all talk to each other.
Right. And this is the hardest part of building a language server, state management. You can't just parse one file in isolation. If file A calls a function that's defined in file B, the server needs to know about file B.
Yeah, and if I change file B,
then file A might suddenly be broken.
Ah.
So the document service has to maintain a global scope. The study guide explains their invalidation strategy. When you type a single character in a file, the server marks that file's URI as dirty.
And clears the cache for it.
It clears the cache, and then it has to rebuild the global symbol table to make sure that if you, say, renamed a function, that change propagates everywhere.
Speaking of rename, that feels like a really high-stakes feature. If I right-click a variable named temp and I rename it to velocity, I need to be 100% sure I'm not renaming every variable named temp in the entire project.
Oh, absolutely.
Just this one and all its references.
And that's where the resolve phase is so critical. When the compiler is building the AST, every time it sees a variable being used, it creates a link back to the node where that variable was defined.
A back reference.
Exactly. The definition node actually keeps a list of every single place it's used. So when you hit rename, the server doesn't search for the string temp. It looks at the definition node you clicked on, grabs that list of references, and sends a workspace edit to update just those specific file locations.
It's surgical.
It has to be. One wrong edit, and the whole thing breaks.
There's another visual feature I want to touch on because I saw it in the notes. Semantic tokens.
Oh, yes. This is the difference between guessing and knowing.
So most syntax highlighting is just rejects, right?
Yeah.
Like if it looks like a keyword, color it blue.
That's the old way. That's text-made grammars. It's just pattern matching. But semantic tokens come from the AST. The server looks at a variable X. It knows that X is a parameter. It knows its type is int. And it knows it's read only.
So it can actually tell the editor, hey, color this X differently from that X over there because this one is read only.
Exactly. TextMate could never do that because it doesn't understand scope or meaning. Semantic tokens give you that high definition highlighting where the color actually tells you something about the code's real behavior.
Okay, so we've built this incredible engine. We have a compiler and LSP, smart features. Now we need to actually put it somewhere people can use it. The project targets VS Code, IntelliJ, and the web.
The web playground, which is really impressive because the language server is written in Node.js.
And you can't run Node in a browser.
You cannot.
So did they have to rewrite the entire thing in browser-compatible JavaScript?
No, and that's the beauty of that libs architecture we talked about at the start. They use web workers.
Okay, so how did that work?
They take the exact same language server code and they bundle it up. But instead of launching it as a separate process on your computer, they spin it up in a background thread inside the browser tab. That's a web worker.
But the communication, JSON-RPC usually goes over standard input and output.
Mm-hmm.
A browser tab doesn't have that.
They just swap the transport layer. Instead of piping to Studin and Stutter, they use the browser's post message API. But the protocol messages, the did open, the hover, are identical.
Oh, the carrier pigeon is different, but the message is the same.
The message is identical. It's the same brain, just floating in a different jar.
That's a great image.
And the playground adds a few of its own custom tricks. It has a two-column view. You write your YAML on the left, and you see the generated TypeScript appear on the right.
And how does the browser know to update that right-hand column when I type?
They extended the protocol. The standard LSP doesn't have a compile this for me command, so they just added a custom request. Compile.
Ah.
When you type, the client sends that custom request, the worker compiles the code to TypeScript, and sends the resulting text back.
Now, we're moving into the really advanced part of the study guide. Collaboration.
The Google Docs effect.
It's just expected now, right? If I'm in a tool, I expect to be able to send a link to my colleague and have them type at the same time as me. But that sounds like a technical nightmare. If we both type at index 5 at the same time, who wins?
In the old days, you needed a central server to be the referee, to say, Alice's keystroke got here first, Bob has to wait. But that's slow. This project uses YJS and CRDTs.
Conflict-free replicated data types. Conflict-free is a very bold promise.
It's a mathematical promise. CRDTs are these incredible data structures designed so that no matter what order the updates arrive in, everyone eventually ends up with the exact same state.
That's the principle of convergence.
Right. It doesn't matter if my edit gets to your computer 500 milliseconds late. The math just handles the merge correctly. The playground uses a WebSocket provider to sync this shared document between all the users. You don't need a central brain.
It empowers the edges of the network. Speaking of math, we have to talk about control flow analysis. The guide says this is probably the hardest part of the exam.
Yeah, this is pure computer science theory. It's about proving facts about your code without actually running it. Like, for example, reaching definitions.
Which is asking the question, that value I assigned to variable X on line 1, is it still the same value by the time I get to line 10?
Or has it been overwritten? Or maybe it went through an if statement where it might have been overwritten. To solve problems like this, you need the five tuple.
Okay, walk me through the five tuple.
It's the framework for any kind of flow analysis. You need a domain, which is what you're tracking. You need a direction. Are you reading forward or backward? A transfer function, how one line of code changes what you know, initial values, and the meet operator.
The meet operator is the interesting one to me.
It's the fork in the road. If you have an if else block, you have two different realities. In the if block, X might be 5. in the else block, x might be 10. When those two paths rejoin, when they meet, what do you know about x?
Is it the union of 5 and 10? The intersection.
Exactly. The meet operator defines how you merge those conflicting realities. And if you get that wrong, your compiler will make false assumptions, and that leads to really subtle bugs in your final software.
And we want to avoid bugs, but we also want speed. The guide brings up incremental compilation.
This ties right back to the caching we were talking about. If I have a huge project with 100 files and I change a comment in file A, I shouldn't have to recompile the other 99.
But how does the compiler know it was just a comment? To the file system, the file changed. The timestamp is different.
It looks at the signature. The system computes a hash, a fingerprint of just the file's public API. The exports, the types, the function headers.
The stuff that other files actually depend on.
Right. A comment is an internal implementation detail. It doesn't change the public signature. So the compiler sees the file change, but the signature hash is identical. So it says, false alarm, I don't need to recompile anything that depends on this.
That's incredibly efficient.
It's the only way large-scale software development is even possible. If you had to recompile the Linux kernel from scratch every time someone fixed a typo, we'd never ship anything.
So efficiency is key. But let's wrap up with something even more critical, security.
Supply chain security. This is a massive topic right now.
We've all heard the horror stories. A developer uses a popular open source library. That library depends on another one, which depends on another. And five layers deep, a hacker slips in some malicious code.
And suddenly your banking app is sending passwords to a server somewhere. The project in this study guide mitigates this using PNPM overrides.
And this is a package manager feature.
Yes. It lets the lead developer act as a dictator. You can say, I don't care what version this tiny sublibrary wants to use. In this project, you are all going to use this specific secure version that I vetted.
You pin the entire dependency tree.
You lock it down. It prevents those deep, invisible vulnerabilities from sneaking in during a routine update.
Okay, one last technical detail. We're compiling YAML to TypeScript. We run the TypeScript in the browser. If there's a crash, the browser's console is going to report an error in the TypeScript file.
Right. Error on line 52 of bundle.js.
But I didn't write bundle.js. I wrote main.yaml. How do I debug the code I actually wrote?
Source maps. This is the Rosetta Stone of web development. The compiler also generates a map file that basically tells the browser's developer tools, hey, I know you're running line 52 of this ugly JavaScript, but that actually corresponds to line 4 of this beautiful original YAML file.
So the browser effectively tricks me into thinking I'm debugging my own code.
It bridges that gap between what you write and what the machine actually executes.
It's just amazing when you think about it. How many layers of translation and abstraction are happening? We have lexers, parsers, ASTs, LSPs, JSON RPC, web workers, CRDTs, source maps, all of it, just so I can type print 1 plus 1 and see the number 2 appear.
It really is a massive, massive industrial infrastructure. And that leads to the final, slightly philosophical point the guide makes about determinism.
This one really stuck with me.
We strive for reproducible builds. If I build the software on my machine today and you build the exact same code on your machine tomorrow, we should get the exact same binary file, bit for bit.
But compilers are just software. They have bugs. They sometimes depend on things like the current timestamp.
Or sometimes they iterate through a list of files, and the order they get them from the hard drive is technically random. If a compiler is non-deterministic, if a stray timestamp or a random seed can change the output, can we ever truly trust that the software we deployed is the same as the software we tested?
If build A isn't identical to build B, then we are, in a way, deploying untested code to our users.
It's the nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
And it's why understanding this black box, this whole tool chain, is so vital. These tools aren't magic. They are complex engineered systems, and they are only as reliable as we, the engineers, build them to be.
A pretty humbling thought for the next time I'm impatiently waiting for that autocomplete menu to pop up. Thanks so much for deconstructing all this with us.
My pleasure.
And to you listening, the next time you see that little red squiggly line appear under your code, give a little nod of respect to the AST that put it there. We'll see you on the next deep dive.